involving himself in combat. He took up bullfighting, deep-sea fishing, and big-game hunting. He would suffer innumerable auto and airplane accidents, but that would only spur his need for more risk. Out of each experience, that sensation of being sparked back to life would return, and he could find his way to yet another novel. This feeling of having your soul pulled out of your body like a handkerchief is the essence of a sublime sensation. For Hemingway, it could be conjured only by something extreme, by a brush with death itself. We, however, can feel the sensation and its reviving benefits in smaller doses. Whenever life feels particularly dull or confining, we can force ourselves to leave familiar ground. This could mean traveling to some particularly exotic location, attempting something physically challenging, a sea voyage or scaling a mountain, or simply embarking on a new venture in which we are not certain we can succeed. In each case, we are experiencing a moment of powerlessness in the face of something large and overwhelming. This feeling of control slipping out of our hands, however short and slight, is a brush with death. We may not make it. We have to raise our level of effort. In the process, our minds are exposed to new sensations. When we finish the voyage or task and come to safe ground, we feel as if we are reborn. We felt that slight pull of the handkerchief. We now have a heightened appreciation for life and a desire to live it more fully. The sense of evanescence and urgency. The first half of the 14th century in Japan was a time of intense turmoil. Palace coups and civil wars turned the country upside down. Those of the educated classes felt particularly disturbed by this chaos. In the midst of all this revolution, a low-ranking palace poet, later known as Kenko, decided to take his vows and become a Buddhist monk. But instead of retiring to a monastery, he remained in the capital, Kyoto, and quietly observed life around him as the country seemed to fall apart. He wrote a series of short pieces that were not published in his lifetime, but were later collected and printed under the name Essays in Idleness, the fame of this book increasing with time. Many of his observations centered on death, which was all too present in that period. But his thoughts around death went the opposite direction of brooding and morbidity. He found in them something pleasurable and even ecstatic. For instance, he pondered the evanescence of beautiful things such as cherry blossoms or youth itself. Quote, "If man were never to fade away like the dews of Adashino, never to vanish like the smoke over Torebeyama, but lingered on forever in the world, how things would lose their power to move us. The most precious thing in life is its uncertainty." This made him think of insects that lived for only a day or a week, and yet how crowded such time could be. It is the shadow of death that makes everything poignant and meaningful to us. Kenko continually found new ways to measure the vastness of time as it stretches into eternity. A man was buried one day in a cemetery in view of Kenko's residence in Kyoto, the grave marker surrounded by grieving members of the family. As the years went by, he wrote, they would come less and less often, their feelings of sorrow slowly fading away. Within a span of time, they would all be dead, and with them the memory of the man they had buried. The grave marker would become largely covered by grass. Those who would pass by centuries later would see it as a weird mix of stone and nature. Eventually, it would disappear altogether, dissolving into the earth. In the face of this undeniable reality, of this eternal expanse, how can we not feel the preciousness of the present? It is a miracle to be alive even one more day. There are two kinds of time we can experience, the banal and the sublime variety. Banal time is extremely limited in scope. It consists of the present moment and stretches out to a few weeks ahead of us, occasionally farther. Locked in banal time, we tend to distort events. We see things as being far more important than they are, unaware that in a few weeks or a year, what stirs us all up will not matter. The sublime variety is an intimation of the reality of the utter vastness of time and the constant changes that are going on. It requires that we lift our heads out of the moment and engage in the kinds of meditations that obsessed Kenko. We imagine the future centuries from now, or what was happening in this very spot millions of years ago. We become aware that everything is in a state of flux. Nothing is permanent. Contemplating sublime time has innumerable positive effects. It makes us feel a sense of urgency to get things done now, gives us a better grasp of what really matters, and instills a heightened appreciation of the passage of time, the poignancy and beauty of all things that fade away. The sense of awe. We are creatures that live in language. Everything we think and feel is framed by words, which never really quite express reality. They are merely symbols. Throughout history, people have had all kinds of unique experiences in which they witness something that exceeds the capacity to express it in words, and this elicits a feeling of awe. In 1915, the great explorer Ernest Shackleton found himself and his crew marooned on an ice floe near the continent of Antarctica. For months, they floated in this desolate landscape, before managing to rescue themselves later the following year. During the time on the floe, Shackleton felt as if he were visiting the planet before humans had arrived on the scene, seeing something unchanged for millions of years. And despite the threat of death this scene represented, he felt oddly exhilarated. In the 1960s, the neurologist Oliver Sacks worked on patients who had been in a coma since the 1920s, victims of the sleeping sickness epidemic of the time. Thanks to a new drug, they were awakened from this coma, and he recorded their thoughts. He realized that they viewed reality in a much different way than anyone else did, which made him wonder about our own perception of the world. Perhaps we see only a part of what is happening around us, because our mental powers are determined by habits and conventions. There could be a reality we are missing. During such meditations, he slipped into a sense of the sublime. In the 1570s, a Huguenot pastor named Jean de Léry was one of the first Westerners to live among the Brazilian tribes in the Bay of Rio. He observed all kinds of rituals that frightened him in their barbarity. But then one evening, he heard tribesmen singing in a way that was so strange and unearthly, he was overwhelmed with a sudden sense of awe. "I stood there transported with delight," he later wrote. "Whenever I remember it, my heart trembles, and it seems their voices are still in my ears." This sense of awe can be elicited by something vast or strange. Endless landscapes, the sea or the desert, monuments from the distant past, the pyramids of Egypt, the unfamiliar customs of people in a foreign land. It can also be sparked by things in everyday life. For instance, focusing on the dizzying variety of animal and plant life around us that took millions of years to evolve into its present form. The philosopher Immanuel Kant, who wrote about the sublime, felt it in holding a swallow in his hands and gazing into its eye, feeling a strange connection between the two of them. It can be created by particular exercises in thinking. Imagine, for example, that you had always been blind and were suddenly granted sight. Everything you saw around you would seem strange and new. The freakish form of trees, the garishness of the color green. Or try imagining the earth in its actual smallness, a speck in vast space. The sublime on this level is merely a way of looking at things in their actual strangeness. This frees you from the prison of language and routine, this artificial world we live in. Experiencing this awe on any scale is like a sudden blast of reality, therapeutic and inspiring. The sense of the oceanic, the connection to all life. In not confronting our mortality, we tend to entertain certain illusions about death. We believe that some deaths are more important or meaningful than others, that of a celebrity or prominent politician, for instance. We feel that some deaths are more tragic, coming too early or from some accident. The truth, however, is that death makes no such discriminations. It is the ultimate equalizer. It strikes rich and poor alike. For everyone, it seems to come too early and can be experienced as tragic. Absorbing this reality should have a positive effect upon us all. We share the same fate with everyone. We all deserve the same degree of compassion. It is what ultimately links all of us together, and when we look at the people around us, we should see their mortality as well. This can be extended further and further into the sublime. Death is what links us to all living creatures as well. One organism must die so another can live. It is an endless process that we are a part of. This is what is known as an oceanic feeling, the sensation that we are not separated from the outside world, but that we are part of life in all its forms. Feeling this at moments inspires an ecstatic reaction, the very opposite of a morbid reflection on death. Reversal of perspective. In our normal perspective, we see death as something diametrically opposed to life, a separate event that ends our days. As such, it is a thought that we must dread, avoid, and repress. But this is false, an idea that is actually born out of our fear. Life and death are inextricably intertwined, not separate. The one cannot exist without the other. From the moment we are born, we carry our death within ourselves as a continual possibility. If we try to avoid or repress the thought, keep death on the outside, we are cutting ourselves off from life as well. If we are afraid of death, then we are afraid of life. We must turn this perspective around and face reality from within, finding a way to accept and embrace death as part of being alive. Only from such a position can we begin to overcome the fear of our mortality, and then all of the smaller fears that plague our lives. The following is a quote from 50 Cent. "When I nearly died, it made me think, this can happen again, any second. I better hurry and do what I want. I started to live like I never lived before. When the fear of death is gone, then nothing can bother you, and nobody can stop you." Acknowledgements. First and foremost, my thanks go to Anna Biller for her loving support, her deft editing of the 50th Law, and her other innumerable contributions to the book. The 50th Law owes its existence to Mark Gerald, 50's literary agent. He brought 50 and me together in the first place, and skillfully guided the project from start to finish. I must also thank my agent, Michael Carlisle, at Inkwell Management, for his equally invaluable contributions. His assistant at Inkwell, Ethan Bassoff, and Robert Miller, publisher extraordinaire of Harper Studio, who played such an important role in shaping the concept of the book. Also at Harper Studio, I would like to thank Debbie Steer, Sarah Birmingham, Katie Salisbury, Kim Lewis, and Nikki Cutler. And for their work on the design of the book, Leah Carlson Stanizic and Mary Shuck. I would like to thank Ryan Holiday for his research assistance, Dove Charney for his support and inspiration, my good friend Lamont Jones for our many discussions on the subject, and Jeffrey Benneker, assistant professor in the Incomparable Classics Department at the University of Wisconsin at Madison, for his scholarly advice. On 50's side, his management group, Violator, gave me tremendous support on the project. For this, I must thank first and foremost Chris Leidy, CEO of Violator and the man behind the throne. Also giving generously of their time were Theo Settlemyer, 50's attorney and business manager, Lori Dobbins, president of Violator, Barry Williams, brand manager. Anthony Butler, better known as AB. Bubba and Hove. Special mention as well goes to Joey P., co-founder of Brand Asset Digital, and to Nikki Martin, president of G-Unit Records, for her invaluable insights on 50 from his earliest days in the business. I would like to thank as well Tony Yayo, Busta Rhymes, Paul Rosenberg, president of Shady Records and Eminem's manager, the novelist Nikki Turner, Quincy Jones III, and Kevin and Tiffany Childs over at Don Diva. I would like to give special mention to George June Bishop for giving me the Southside tour and helping me understand the rich world of hustling. Finally, for their immeasurable support during the writing of the book, I would like to thank my mother, Lorette, my sister, Leslie, and, as always, my cat, Brutus. Robert Greene.
This recording of The 50th Law by 50 Cent and Robert Greene was produced and directed by Dennis Kao and read by Robert Greene. It was recorded at Outlaw Sound. It was edited by James Bennett. Mixing and mastering were by James Bennett. We hope you've enjoyed this program from Harper Audio. For more information about the broad range of titles from Harper Audio, Harper Children's Audio, and Cadman, please visit our website at www.harperaudio.com. Thank you for listening.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.